Spirituality Challenged is a podcast recorded on Canadian Treaty 1 territory, and that the land on which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene people, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We acknowledge that our water is sourced from Shoal Lake 41st Nation, which is located on Treaty 3 territory. Spirituality Challenged respects the spirit and intent of treaties and treaty making and are open to future partnerships with First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people in the spirit of truth, reconciliation, and collaboration. Step right up, dear listener. Don't be shy. Nobody likes a party pooper. On this episode of Spirituality Challenged, we are going to put the spotlight on another Winnipeg church in my hometown that has gone through internet fame. Now, in all seriousness, unfortunately, due to the fact that this was originally recorded in February due to renovations in this apartment and moving to another place, I will be redoing an extensive edit to this episode later on, which will include the latest Easter shenanigans that has gone on at a former church that I was involved in. Like I said, dear listener, we're gonna have fun with this episode. It's sort of lighthearted, but it gets a little heavy in the end. Now, I have no beef with this church at this time, unless we're talking about members who I used to be friends with who tried to get me in the Freedom Convoy. Today, we're going to be discussing something that this church hilariously resisted called anti-theatricality. Now, why are we going into this, you ask? Well, just for fun, I decided to do some research into the Easter plays done by Church of the Rock, which gained some virality online through their plays performed on Easter services. The plays would many times involve a famous movie character like Luke Skywalker, Jack Sparrow, or Iron Man. He would die in the play, just like Jesus Christ, only to be resurrected in a similar vein. The Easter plays revolved around reenacting scenes from a relevant movie while adding touches of the Easter story like the Last Supper and resurrection scenes. And of course, like a typical Easter service, the plays were concluded with a sermon from church pastor Mark Hughes, which related to the movie reenacted. Some hilarious examples of these what are called morality plays are Joy Story, Robin of the Hood, Pirates of the Galligan, Raider of the Lost Ark, purity culture vibes, The Lion King of Judah, The Princess Bride of Christ, and last year, they had me laughing till I cried after seeing a Facebook ad for Beauty and the Beaster. And you know what, to this day, sometimes this question runs through my mind. What the hell is a beaster? The plays ran yearly on Easter 2008 with a Star Trek themed play and were held almost every subsequent year with the exceptions of the pandemic years. And if you want my extended but short take on why these kind of services are considered odd or laughable to me, check out the previous episode on Christian Techno's lack of ints. And as a special treat, if you want to check out, laugh at, overanalyze, or even watch previous Church of the Rock plays of the past, I left a link in the show notes to an archive.org post with every single video recorded play except this year's on downloadable MP4 format, which you can watch and laugh your ass off all you want. A big shout out to Archiver 1579 for putting this together and uploading it to the internet. Cause archive.org, the internet is forever. Welcome to Spirituality Challenge, dear listener. I'm your host, Aaron Parsons. On this podcast, we uncover the rarely discussed history and expose sources behind controversial Christian ideologies while speaking truth to power. We try to cover as much ground within an hour on one topic in each episode, so sit back, relax, and prepare to be challenged. So, what is anti-theatricality? Believe it or not, dear listener, there were times when Christians believed that the dramatic arts had no purity at all and would lead all members watching dramatizations into the lake of fire. Anti-theatricality refers to any form of opposition or hostility to theater, reflecting a deep-seated ambivalence in human nature about the dramatic arts. It encompasses objections based on philosophy, religion, morality, psychology, aesthetics, and simple prejudice. Throughout history, church leaders and various religious and philosophical movements have expressed opposition to theater for reasons ranging from its perceived distance from reality to its potential moral and societal influence. One of the earliest documented objections to theatrical performance was made by Plato around 400 BC. He argued that acting and theater of the day could negatively influence individuals and society. In his writings called The Republic, Plato brought up concerns about the potential impact of drama on people's emotions and moral character. Plato focused on tragedies and comedies, and being the Stoic that he was, felt that emotions and behaviors could be harmful, because witnessing exaggerated emotions and immoral actions on stage could lead to the audience experiencing similar emotions in their own lives while eventually adapting immoral behavior. Plato was generally skeptical of emotions, associating them with the irrational part of the soul. He believed that emotions could cloud rational judgment and lead to impulsive actions that strayed away from justice. Additionally, Plato was wary of the influence of the poets and playwrights behind these performances. He felt that allowing content creators to shape the narratives and emotions of the public could undermine the pursuit of a society of law and order. In essence, Plato was concerned about how the arts in general would influence the moral fabric of his community. While there are many rabbit holes and interpretations to look into while understanding Plato's disgust for theater, it's important to note, dear listener, that Plato believed true knowledge could only be acquired through reason and intellect. To the Stoic philosopher, opinions based on sensory perception were considered less reliable because the physical world was seen as deceptive and ever-changing. In the Middle Ages, church leaders echoed Plato's moral objections towards theater in an aged historical moral panic. Church leaders were wary of the influence that theater could have on public opinion and behavior. They feared that certain performances might undermine religious values, encourage vice, or challenge the authority of the church. The church discouraged people from attending plays for several reasons, and as we all know, the church, as a moral authority at the time, sought to regulate artistic expression and condone elements in plays that were deemed immoral, blasphemous, or sacrilegious. Some performances included themes or characters that the church considered inappropriate or contrary to the religious teachings at the time. Thomas Becon, an English priest, wrote a book in exile during the reign of Queen Mary in 1559 called The Displaying of the Popish Mass. In the book, Becon wrote an argument with the church and ritualized theatricality of his community. He objected to the introduction of ceremonial costume, ritual gesture, and theatrical elements during church mass because he believed that entertainment is distracting from the true purpose of worship, and acting out characters, even for educational purposes, were unnecessary additions to the religious experience. It's essential to consider that the church's stance on theater varied across regions and periods, and not everyone within the church held the same views. Nevertheless, the church's influence did contribute to a more cautious approach towards theatrical performances during the Middle Ages. Later on, the church became extremely uncomfortable with certain English Renaissance theatrics, and of course, drag and sexism were problems in this prim and proper setting of England. There were only male actors in every single play, and some of those male actors performed female roles. This issue was explored by Ben Jonson in Shakespeare, and it sparked anxiety over the potential effeminizing effect on the mind. Essentially, A good number of male thought leaders believed that male actors wearing women's clothing could adulterate the dominant gender, reflecting a deep anxiety over gender roles and moral implications at the time. And there was something called the player's scourge or actor's tragedy. It does have another name that rhymes with the Matrix, and I had a hard time pronouncing it. This is a significant work that represents the culmination of the Puritan attack on English Renaissance theater. Written by William Prynne, this Bible-sized text presents a thorough and impassionate rant against various types of theater. Prynne's massive beef with theater was that it put pleasure and recreation over work, and that its excitement and effeminacy caused the audience to get horny. The title page of the work renders popular stage plays as pernicious corruptions, lewd, heathenish, ungodly spectacles, and yes, sinful. Condemned in all ages as intolerable mischiefs to the churches, republics, and the minds, manners, and souls of men. The written words of this thick book reflects the deep-seated spiritual and cultural moral panics held by many Puritans during that time. Now in the 1790s, William Wilberforce, a prominent English politician, expressed strong disapproval of contemporary theater. Following his evangelical conversion to Christ, Wilberforce's views on theater shifted to the point where he also wrote a book filled with seething called A Practical View of the Prevailing Religious System of Professed Christians, in which he described the theater as a place haunted by debauchees bent on gratifying their appetites, where modesty and regularity had retreated, and where riots and lewdness were invited. Wilberforce's critique of theater reflected his belief that it promotes behaviors and attitudes contrary to true godliness. His disapproval of theater was part of a wider call towards a genuine and moral way of life, emphasizing the importance of individual behavior, family unity, and the trustworthiness of leaders. This stance aligns with his broader efforts to promote a society based on moral values and ethical conduct, kind of like our friends in the GOP. In more recent times, scholars and commenters have reevaluated anti-theatricality as an inevitable and valuable part of the theater dynamic, recognizing its complexity and multifaceted role within the theater. This shift in perspective has led a more nuanced understanding of anti-theatrical views, moving away from a purely negative portrayal to a recognition of its integral and complex nature within the theatrical world. Despite all the religious lawsuits against playwrights and the call for church laity to be unblemished, pure, holy, and acceptable unto God, the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution, and 19th century progress in general led early evangelicals, before they went all fundy, to try to eliminate poverty. Some of these organizations were created to help working women, particularly those whose occupation placed them in quote-unquote exceptional moral danger. Evangelical groups tended towards charity for the oppressed as they directed their time and energy towards what they considered to be root causes of poverty. One such British movement was the Theatrical Mission, established in 1873 by two evangelicals. Those involved aimed to provide support for vulnerable girls employed in traveling theater companies. The mission's initial focus was on groups that toured in their area, and by 1884, the mission was sending out approximately 1,000 supportive letters a month. They also opened a club called Macready House on Henrietta Street near the London theaters, which provided affordable lunches, teas, and later free hotel rooms for the actors. The mission also looked after children employed on the stage, and for any girl who was pregnant, they encouraged her to seek help from the Theatre Ladies Guild, which would help with finding a midwife and getting the new mother into a good paying job after the baby was born. The mission garnered royal patronage, indicating its significance and impact within the community. However, towards the end of the century, an undercover journalist from the era investigated Macready House and gave the organization a very bad review. Before the Frankenstein experiment that merged pop culture with Christianity, the church and the stage were merged together, and a baby popped out called The Sign of the Cross. This play was produced by Wilson Barrett at the Grand Opera House with the intention of bridging the gap between church members and the stage. Barrett expressed his hope that the denouncers of his work of art would meet him halfway to reconcile their differences. Also, Ben Greet, an English actor manager, formed a touring Sign of the Cross company, which proved popular in England and Australia. The play aimed to bring the church and the stage closer together by targeting audiences that usually aren't seen in the theater, which inspired the church and stage guild, found by Reverend Stuart Headlam, with the mission of breaking down prejudice against theaters, actors, music hall artists, stage singers, and dancers. The guild attracted over 470 members within a year, including clergy and theater professionals, signifying a growing movement to promote acceptance and understanding between the church and the stage. And thanks to companies like these, Church of the Rock can give us internet viral masterpieces filled with laughter, cheesy biblical references and theological shoutouts, and a perfect yearly reminder through drama that one man gave his life to save the world. Well, sort of. And he inspired pop culture characters to kind of do the same thing, I guess? This is where I become divided as a media critic. On one hand, I appreciate excellent storytelling, along with the exploration of uplifting themes in a chronicle, whether we're talking about friendship, overcoming obstacles, or antagonists with minimal odds of winning, and sometimes anti-heroes gaining a good sense of altruism. On the other hand, I'm fascinated by certain ideas involving anti-theatricality. I'm intrigued by the idea that there should actually be limitations to the creative process, even though I don't fully agree with that. Now, I'm not advocating for censorship of certain ideas, and I'm definitely not saying certain media should be completely shut down based on my own moral code. I'm saying that it's possible that figures like Plato may have a point when it comes to emotions affecting rational judgment. In a sense, Plato predicted that both evangelical shepherds and sheep would eventually use the art of storytelling to manipulate the complete flock. And it doesn't just happen through Church of the Rock Easter plays, but through what's called radical testimonies. Think about it. It doesn't matter if we're talking about church or an MLM. A testimony serves as social proof no matter if it's true, false, or exaggerated. And most of the time, when I look into people's testimonies at church, including my own, I've come to the conclusion that most stories told don't make anyone special at all. Testimonies offer potential customers or cult members a kind of insight into toxic positive experiences of others with a product or how a church changed a person's life. What testimonials do is that they attempt to create a sense of trust and reliability, influencing purchasing, volunteering, donation, and worst of all, conversion decisions that do anything from drain a person's income to causing them to storm the US Capitol. Companies and churches strategically use testimonies to highlight specific features, benefits, supernatural results, and other overrated or overhyped over-the-top BS which gets the public on the outside, addressing potential concerns around how brands are built. When focusing on the context of cults, testimonials are often employed to reinforce a sense of community and devotion among members. Members sharing their positive experience create a collective hive mind, reinforcing a group's ideology. And sadly, this can be the case amongst smaller groups of ex-evangelicals. A cultish emotional bonding experience helps solidify loyalty and commitment within a group, making it challenging for individuals to question, leave, or confront people who are in authority. Testimonies must be approached critically. In both marketing and cults, the presented information may be selective, and in most evangelical, non-denominational, charismatic NAR churches, it is heavily biased towards the far right. Examining a range of perspectives and considering different viewpoints is essential for making well-informed decisions and avoiding undue influence, whether we're talking about attending a church service, going to a concert for a huge rock star, or seeing an Easter play at Church of the Rock. The thing is, we all need to face reality at some point. And just because someone doesn't believe in reality, doesn't mean reality doesn't exist. Reality isn't an opinion, and opinion isn't reality. I may have an opinion that you don't like, dear listener, and that's perfectly fine. But I need to make sure my opinion at least backs up reality, otherwise I'm a liar that may cause some serious problems to innocent people. Reality is still real regardless if a person chooses to believe it or not. Choosing to not believe in actual reality is what Plato was getting at here. Because resisting belief in reality, or not letting fear hold you back, according to Springs, is what people do when they are in a cult. So Plato, in a sense, was right. Using the marketing tactics of both morality plays and testimonial storytelling are enough to ensure that cult-like behavior is cemented in a toxic culture. While it may not necessarily have been implied, Plato probably would have came up with the conclusion that extensive exposure to unreal, unfactual, or unquestionable ideas leads to binary thinking, feeling special, avoiding suffering, and refusing to accept that one is wrong in an argument. It can also lead to letting leadership and advisors who provide services dictate what healthcare you should work with, what books you should read, what friends you can have, and how much money you can make, if you can vote, or who you can marry. Or maybe I'm just overanalyzing all this. Maybe I'm swimming in too much of a good thing called reality. And I need to at least watch some of the previous plays from the archive to form a different opinion. Alrighty. I guess instead of my typical binge podcast listening of conspirituality and the Straight White American Jesus roundups on Fridays, maybe I should put all that aside for a Sunday morning and check out Joy's story. Nah.